loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, it's our regular news segment called Women and Society with Professor Hannah Dickinson, where today, on the day that President Trump will give his State of the Union speech, we will review the State of the Union for women, including healthcare, immigration, abortion access, and much more. And then today, we continue our weekly series. It's every Tuesday, called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump this evening will deliver his second State of the Union address. The president is expected to focus on immigration and on his demands for a border wall and his threats to declare a national emergency to build that border wall, as well as the opioid crisis, the economy, and sentencing reform. Will the American people see the so-called presidential Donald Trump of last year's State of the Union, or will we see the angry Donald Trump of Twitter? Next, the U.S. envoy to the Korean peace talks, Stephen Biegun, will meet with high-level officials in North Korea tomorrow as preparations for the second Kim-Trump summit go down to the wire. There's also anticipation that crucial new details about the summit will be announced by President Trump during tonight's State of the Union address. Then, senior Afghan officials, including former President Hamid Karzai, met with Taliban representatives in Moscow today, weeks after the insurgents met with U.S. representatives to discuss an end to the war. Again, however, no Afghan government officials were present, and President Ashraf Ghani strongly criticized the talks as undermining his government. And then President Trump announced on Twitter yesterday that he will nominate Acting Interior Secretary David Bernhardt to formally take over the job from former Secretary Ryan Zinke, who resigned 2 months ago under an ethics cloud. Bernhardt is a former oil and agriculture industry lobbyist who Congressman Raul Grijalva, the chairman of the House Interior Committee, described as, quote, everything that's wrong with this administration, unquote. And finally, today we begin a new weekly segment dealing with the ongoing militarization of space. As the U.S. continues to withdraw from international arms treaties, will the weaponization and militarization of space bring the world closer to catastrophe? And in other headlines, federal prosecutors subpoenaed financial and other records from the Trump inaugural committee, which spent $107 million on the 2017 ceremony. One focus of the subpoena is a venture capitalist, Imad Zuberi, who donated $900,000 and was a fundraiser and donor for the Clintons and for Barack Obama in past years. The White House confirmed today that President Trump is nominating U.S. Treasury official David Malpass to head the World Bank. Malpass was chief economist at the investment bank Bear Stearns from 1993 until it collapsed in the 2008 financial crisis. He's known as a World Bank critic. The U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security released a statement today saying, quote, there is no evidence to date that any identified activities of a foreign government or foreign agent had a material impact on the integrity or security of election infrastructure or political campaign infrastructure used in the 2018 midterm elections. This announcement runs counter to the narrative that the U.S. faces a rising tide of efforts by foreign powers, particularly Russia, to meddle in the elections. Today would have been Trayvon Martin's 24th birthday. In February 2012, George Zimmerman shot and killed Trayvon, a 17-year-old African-American boy who was unarmed and visiting his relatives in the gated community in Florida where Zimmerman lived. The shooting prompted large protests nationwide and was one of many racist shootings that sparked the Black Lives Matter movement. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our regular segment, which we do every Tuesday, called Women and Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Today, we're going to be focusing especially about the state of women in the United States as Donald Trump prepares his State of the Union address. Hannah Dickinson is a professor and she is an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. Professor Dickinson joins us from Geneva, New York, and we're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. Nicole is a Sputnik news analyst and a producer of this show. Hannah, Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks.
So happy to be here.
All right, State of the Union. We talked to Ted Rall earlier in preparation for a segment that we're going to do later today, and Ted Rall compared the State of the Union to being a big, boring mess. And of course, in many ways it is. There's a lot of anticipation, and then it's just this terrible sort of routine effort by whoever the president of the United States is to claim credit for all the great things that are going on in the United States, ignoring for the most part all of the terrible problems that people are facing, the oppression people are facing. But we want to focus in this segment about the state of the union for women in particular in the United States, because the crisis facing women and other parts of society associated with the oppression of women is so big and yet so not talked about ever in the State of the Union address, whoever the president is or has been. So we want to focus on that. Professor Dickinson, let's get started. Where do you want to take us?
So I think any review of the state of life for women in the U.S. in 2018 has to include the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. So I expect that we'll see tonight Trump touting this nomination, and I think we may see him spending some significant time talking about abortion in particular, as one of the things his administration is really fighting to make illegal again in the U.S. A couple things here. One, we should talk about the remarkable fight back against Kavanaugh's nomination, but also I think in some really interesting way at the grassroots, right? But also we're seeing state legislatures and senates preparing for a possible future in which the Supreme Court can't be trusted to protect women's reproductive health. So actually, a whole array of states have pursued or are pursuing expanded reproductive health care coverage or protections for women in specific states. So I think we've got an interesting tension here when we're thinking both about the Supreme Court and the sort of state of reproductive health for women in the U.S.
That's Professor Hannah Dickinson. She joins us every week at this time to talk about the crisis, challenges, struggles facing women in the United States. Nicole Roussel is also our guest in this segment. Nicole, picking up on what Hannah talked about, I'm looking at a Guttmacher website, guttmacher.org. State policy trends 2018 with Roe v. Wade in jeopardy. States continue to add new abortion restrictions. Abortion, even without the elimination of Roe v. Wade by some judicial order, abortion or the ability to access abortion, the legal right of all women, has largely disappeared for big parts of the country.
It has. And that's been going on for decades, really has really sped up, I think, in the last 10 years. And in the last year, in the state of the current union, since the last State of Union address, we've seen a lot of increasing restriction. And as we've talked about on the show, as these laws have come down, as these rulings have come down, it is extremely clear that extremists and right-wing politicians in this country are working really hard to try to restrict abortion so severely that it will get back up to the Supreme Court so that they can rule on it. When they ruled on Roe v. Wade, they didn't rule squarely on women's rights for abortion. They ruled in a more narrow way. And so it is clear that there is a legal strategy here to try to get abortion rights specifically and squarely addressed by the very, very conservative Supreme Court to try to outlaw this entirely. And so the way we are seeing that, for example, in Iowa, that was the most extreme abortion restriction in 2018, and it banned abortion once a heartbeat could be detected, once cardiac activity could be detected. As these cells are growing, the heart starts to grow, as you can see or hear the heart starting to work. That's about 6 weeks of gestation. So, you know, this is not very long after conception. And in some cases, people might not actually know that they are, in fact, pregnant. And so this was, you know, such an extreme bill, such an extreme piece of legislation that it was immediately challenged in court. And so is not yet actually being put into effect because it's been challenged in court, because it's so extreme and because it's clearly goes squarely against the Roe v. Wade decision. But that has triggered other states doing the same thing. So Louisiana and Mississippi adopted measures this year banning abortion at 15 weeks. Those are also being challenged in court. It's, you know, these are clearly laws that are not legal, but they are being put forward so that they can go to the Supreme Court.
Hannah Dickinson, I'm looking at the New York Times, a piece from 2 years. Well, it's a year and 4 months ago. The headline is Trump is rapidly reshaping the judiciary. Here's how. Now, this was way back 14 months ago, so still in Trump's first year. I want to read a couple sentences to you, and then I want to talk about what the implications are for women and, of course, for labor, for civil rights and civil liberties across the board. We're having a particular focus on women. But then I want to also talk about, given the reality of what Donald Trump and the right wing are doing with the courts, what the alternatives are for people who want to fight for rights, fight for new rights or fight to expand existing rights or to defend rights that are under attack. Here's what the article says. In the weeks before Donald J. Trump took office, lawyers joining his administration gathered at a law firm near the Capitol, where Donald McGahn II, the soon-to-be White House counsel, filled a whiteboard with a secret battle plan to fill the federal appeals courts with young and deeply conservative judges. Mr. McGahn, instructed by Mr. Trump to maximize the opportunity to reshape the judiciary, mapped out potential nominees and a strategy according to two people familiar with the effort. Start by filling vacancies on appeals court with multiple openings and where Democratic senators up for re-election next year in states won by Mr. Trump, like Indiana, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, could be pressured not to block his nominees. And to speed them up through confirmation, avoid clogging the Senate with too many nominees for the district courts, where legal philosophy is less crucial. Now, this comes after the Republicans blocked Obama from filling almost any vacancy in the appellate courts and certainly blocked his ability to fill even a vacant Supreme Court justice. Again, this is a profound reordering of the judiciary. And I have to say, Professor Dickinson, you don't hear much clamor about it from the Democratic Party, even though the consequences could be so significant that it will impact people's rights and women's rights, not just for a couple of years, but these are young right-wing judges. We're talking about maybe 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the nomination of judges will be perhaps Donald Trump's most longstanding legacy, right? Whether he's reelected or not. That damage is done. We're talking about judges who are not elected and who are appointed for life. And Trump and his administration know that. Just a couple weeks ago, he renominated 51 of his judicial nominees who didn't make it to confirmation votes last year. That's 51 in one swoop. And, you know, one of those is, I don't know if you've been following this story, Naomi Rao. She's being appointed or potentially appointed to Kavanaugh's seat on the circuit court. And not only has she come under some real controversy since her nomination for some comments in which she's blaming survivors of sexual assault for their rapes. She's got a horrible record on reproductive health and LGBTQ rights, especially around access to healthcare. And then The Intercept had a story yesterday where they focused on the ways in which she has actually been holding up workplace guidance on sexual harassment and assault in the workplace here in the era of Me Too for 15 months. So there's a strong trend here, right? Not only with the appointment of judges that we will be potentially living with for decades, unless we can find some other way forward, and really sort of careful, I don't know what another word for it, but sort of disgusting attempt to put in place not just judges that will hold up the Trump administration position on women's health, but all of these other ways in which women's rights are not being legally followed by this administration and potentially their judicial nominees.
And I'm really glad you brought up this female judge, because I think this has been going on for a couple years, but one thing that happened in the last year since the last State of the Union is that Gina Haspel was nominated and was confirmed to be the CIA director. And one of the big talking points around Gina Haspel was that she was going to be the first female CIA director. And I was completely enraged by this argument. I mean, this argument also happened while Hillary Clinton was running, right? And this is the classic identity politics being raised above, you know, what will happen for all of the women under the policies that these individual women that might be, you know, these individual women would be elevated, and that would be important. But their policies around women, their policies that will be, you know, huge detriments to women in this nation, in this union, and worldwide, are horrendous. I would much rather see a man get into office who has better policies than a woman who to get into office who has terrible, terrible policies for women and men globally. Or, of course, there are myriad women all around this country who would do a much better job as CIA director than Gina Haspel, or who would be a much better president than Hillary Clinton. But I think this year in particular, we saw a lot of talk about how important it was to elevate, you know, this woman to this one status, and how that will change the state of our nation. But it won't, not with the policies that are so anti-women.
Well, and it's a tactic that the far right has recently adopted, and that, you know, as you say, Nicole, the Democrats I participate in too, right? Where there's a sense that they think voters, that working people, everyday American citizens, like, are too stupid to notice anything beyond the gender that a particular person is performing or enacting, right? Like, we saw this with the GOP nominees to the, or appointments to the Judiciary Committee, right? A big hurrah somehow that there are now women on the Judiciary Committee. If you can remember from the Kavanaugh hearings, right, that that line of old stern white men, right? And we're supposed to feel happy that they've been replaced by women. But of course, they're some of the most anti-choice members of the Senate, right? So again, I don't think people are fooled by identity politics when all it does is make some optics, when actually what's happening is rights are being rolled back.
I couldn't agree more. I think there's another, there are endless topics on the State of the Union for women, because honestly, any domestic issue or international issue can be viewed through the lens of women and women's oppression. One thing I really wanted to talk about is the rollback of protections for LGBTQ people. We've seen under the Trump administration a lot of rollbacks, especially for trans and non-binary people, including not being able to serve in the military. Which for people who are trans and non-binary, who have been in the military and who have, had their careers, their salaries, their lives invested into, this path, this has been a horrendous rollback. And I would love to hear more thoughts about these protections that are being eroded from you, Dr. Dickinson.
I'm so glad you raised this, Nicole. I mean, I don't think, right, we can't talk about the state of the union for women without talking about the state of the union for LGBTQ folks. And trans people in particular have seen a whole set of attacks at the federal and the state levels on their rights. And one I just wanted to really sort of hold up is some shifts in guidance around non-discrimination that are working to sort of codify biological notions of gender into our understanding of how discrimination works, right? So in practice, what this means is, under the law, potentially trans people can't claim, right, that they've been discriminated against in the workplace, in the prison, in their encounters with the state, right? Because actually, the federal government is invested in making sure that trans and gender nonconforming people aren't understood as impacted by gender-based discrimination, which, you know, is truly counterintuitive and cruel.
Yeah, that's the voice of Professor Hannah Dickinson. We're also speaking with Nicole Roussel in this segment, which airs every Tuesday on Loud and Clear. Nicole, there's other issues when we look at the judiciary. We look at Brett Kavanaugh, of course, Donald Trump. The issues are interconnected. We started with the struggle to defend abortion rights. They're under assault by Trump and by all of these right-wing judges. And it didn't start with Trump. This has been a long-standing campaign. There's other issues. I mean, Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch, the new members, Trump-nominated members of the Supreme Court, viciously anti-labor. I mean, if you go through their history, these same people, they're attacking women's rights, they're attacking LGBTQ rights, they're attacking the rights of the African-American community, they're attacking the rights of unions. Kavanaugh, in particular, has been the most egregious, perhaps the most anti-labor of all of them. It just goes back to the issue of strategy. Like, if the courts are being stacked with right-wing judges, we have a situation where these judges are attacking everyone's rights. And one, if women are fighting for women, and if labor is fighting for labor, and if the LGBTQ community is fighting for that community, and the Black community is fighting for the Black community, everybody's fighting sort of separately, rather than understanding that these right-wing justices, and it's not just the courts, but we're focusing on the courts at the moment, they're attacking everyone's rights, and thus we should all actually be fighting together. And you know what? The thing that unites everyone also is that we're all human beings, meaning one, we're born and eventually we die, and also inevitably we get sick. And so the issue of healthcare is a point of unity. And again, we have to understand that the assaults on all these different communities and sectors and constituencies is basically an assault on social rights, and first and foremost amongst them. And I think this is key to fashioning a fight back strategy is the issue of healthcare.
I think it is. And before we move into healthcare, I do want to just add that, you know, when you're talking about labor rights, you're talking about people banding together. You're talking about erasing and starting to push back on some of the income inequality that we've seen really expand throughout the last couple of decades. And so, you know, unions will help lower that income inequality. And the people who will benefit from that most are women, because women are the most in poverty, you know, of the genders. These are the people who are in poverty. These are the people who are struggling to feed their families. So speaking of struggling to feed their families and working on some of that income inequality issues, we've seen a huge attack on healthcare benefits this year specifically. Medicaid expansion happened in some states, but many states also developed a legal strategy where they were able to apply for and receive waivers from certain elements of Medicaid expansion. Arkansas in June was the first state to require that able-bodied Medicaid recipients have to do some sort of work or volunteering or job training or classes to keep their benefits despite needing those benefits regardless, because everyone needs healthcare regardless of whether you're working, whether you're disabled, whether you're in school. And Kentucky and several other states have been doing that. So Arkansas was the first, and in the first 6 months of implementing that that work requirement, more than 18,000 people have lost their Medicaid coverage. And again, when you talk about income inequality, when you talk about losing healthcare coverage, you're mostly talking about women. Women are going to be impacted more than anyone else.
I'm glad that we're talking about healthcare, poverty, and labor, right, in this conversation about the state of women's rights in the U.S. Because you're right, Brian, they are linked. And one of the ways I think we might characterize this last year for around gender justice in the U.S. has to do with a whole set of invisible rollbacks, right? So we're seeing the attack on Medicaid that Nicole was just describing. We're seeing rollbacks of access to food stamps and nutritional programs, child care assistance, subsidized housing. There are 13 million people living in poverty in the U.S., and Nicole's right, the majority of them are women and children who are receiving none of those benefits, right, and are still struggling with poverty. So while we see a kind of erosion of a social safety net as if much of one existed in the first place, we're also seeing an attack or a renewed attack after the or in the wake of the Red for Ed teacher strikes of last year and the renewed teacher strikes this year at the state and federal level, attacks on union rights. And so it would be a mistake, I think, not to think that those are utterly related, that as what little financial security and social safety net women and families have access to erodes, it becomes more and more crucial that women stand up and fight for both their own wages and access to healthcare. And when we're talking about teachers, when we're talking about nurses who are part of the face of this sort of renewed labor movement in the U.S., we're also talking about people who see on the front lines every single day the ways that their communities are impacted by a really cruel war on the poor, right, that has been going on for a long time, but has really escalated under the Trump administration.
Yeah, Red for Ed and the massive, really important teacher strikes are such a great example of what happens when everyone stands together, right? When all of these teachers, all of these students, community members, nurses, counselors, everyone stands together and says, this isn't working. We need basic rights. We demand these basics for education. And, you know, that's inevitably what happened also for Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade was a court ruling, but the only reason that happened was because men, women, children, everyone was standing in the streets and saying, we need basic rights for women. Women have a right to their own bodies, to their own healthcare decisions. And as we're seeing these attacks throughout this past year, we've seen women stand up for themselves. We've seen men stand up for women. And we're going to have to keep doing that. We're going to have to keep protesting. We're going to have to keep moving, keep striking, keep talking, and keep demanding what we need as women.
30 seconds left. Dr. Hannah Dickinson, take us out.
So I just want to talk about one more crucial issue, I think, around women's rights over the last year, where this kind of united fight back is happening. And that's around the issue of family separation. So I don't think we can talk about reproductive justice without talking about the importance of families staying together. And there's a really, really upsetting trend, both in rhetoric and practice from the Trump administration, in which certain families get held up. Those are white families. Those are religious families. And other families are subjected to really cruel state intervention, including separation. And we've seen this week, in particular, some news that the Trump administration still has not been able to reunite families and is now claiming that they are not going to bother reuniting kids who've already been placed with sponsor families with their birth families because somehow that would be too traumatic. And so, again, we see a war on women and families and true reproductive justice.
That's the voice of Hannah Dickinson. Hannah is a professor. She is an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. She joins us every Tuesday in this segment on Loud and Clear. We were also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us from San Francisco. He is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Where should we start? Of course, there's the State of the Union address tonight. I'm sure President Trump will, as all previous presidents have done, talk about how great it's going in the United States because, of course, his leadership has made the difference. But I'm not sure if we want to start there or go to some other story. Again, I'm looking at something you flagged called, it's a weirdly titled article. I think it's a weird article, actually, called America's Love Affair with Cheap Drugs Has a Hidden Cost.
Yeah, that is an investigative report by Bloomberg, and I'd be happy to dig into that and then also talk about the State of the Union coming up. The title is a little bit of a misnomer. I'm surprised we have cheap drugs. My understanding was that healthcare in the United States was largely unaffordable, but...
Yeah. I just was like, what? Cheap drugs? I mean, people go to Canada. They go to Mexico. The drugs are not cheap. I mean, they should be affordable, but for many people, they're not.
Yeah, absolutely. It's referencing generic drugs, which are drugs that are produced once a patent expires, where any company can technically try to replicate this drug and thus charge a much cheaper price, as opposed to a company that gets exclusive monopoly rights having to create the drug and then can charge whatever they'd like. And really what it's talking about is the drug manufacturing industry and how they did an investigative report on a company called Mylan, which makes about $12 billion in revenue in 2017, and it produces generic drugs. And what the FDA found when they investigated them was basically rampant fraud, where they were engaging in testing and quality control of these supposed drugs, which is absolutely required under federal regulations, and then destroying the results or hiding the results or burying them. So, for example, they found tons and tons of shredded documents within the facilities that they were inspecting, which is in itself a violation. You can't actually destroy documentation when you're testing these things. You have to preserve all documents. And so four inspectors reviewed Mylan, found huge instances of fraud, and also started to realize that this was really a systemic thing throughout the drug industry, that the generics they were producing, they were either under testing or bearing the results, that they could have certain side effects, certain issues, or just not be nearly as effective as they're claiming to be. And these drug companies are essentially hiding those results. Normally, this would result in some serious action from the regulators. They started to prepare an angry letter, which Bloomberg claims is like the worst thing that they can do is write this letter of warning, which I think is a little ridiculous. But all of a sudden, it was buried. In May of 2017, they suddenly stopped prosecuting this agency and this particular company and decided, well, they'd leave it a go. So in July of 2017, the higher-ups of the FDA decided to take it easy on them and decided to kind of back off. And the drug manufacturer promised to do better, and it was having data integrity issues. Apparently, shredding your documents that have results you don't like is a data integrity issue. But, you know, the article goes on to say it's not just Mylan that's a problem. It's not just like there's this one company out there that the FDA happened to catch. That really it's industry-wide, and that what we're seeing in the prescription drug industry is this kind of rampant fraud where we're just taking their word for it that these drugs work and that we have federal agencies that are in charge of making sure that they aren't misrepresenting themselves to us. And that's actually what we're seeing here. So I think it's really relevant to talk about because the hidden cost they're referring to is the fact that many of these drugs may be ineffective or not work at all. So you're paying less, but you're paying less for nothing. And I think it really just goes to speak to the overall healthcare crisis in the United States, that this is just another aspect of it where health and wellness and, you know, the elimination of sickness is a commodity that we can trade and buy and sell in an open market.
You know, I want to say something about Mylan too, Mylan specifically. Mylan's a major pharmaceutical company. And it produces the EpiPen, right? It's an epinephrine injection that people with severe allergies have to carry with them all the time. In case you have an allergic attack, you go into anaphylactic shock. It gives you epinephrine and adrenaline. I have a deadly shellfish allergy, and I have to carry these doggone things. They used to cost me a buck, right? With my health insurance, whatever the insurance was, and I've had several different health insurance plans over the years, cost me a buck. Well, the CEO of Mylan happens to be the daughter of Senator Joe Manchin, the pretend Democrat from the state of West Virginia. She raised the price, the copay of the EpiPen to $600. So now I have no EpiPen.
$1 to $600.
To $600. So I haven't had an EpiPen in 4 years now. I just simply can't afford it. And I have to be extra careful not to come into contact with shellfish. She also did something that was quite a scandal in Pittsburgh. I'm from the Western Pennsylvania, the Pittsburgh area. She was enrolled to get an MBA at the University of Pittsburgh as the CEO of Mylan. And she just didn't go to class. She's too important. She's too busy. Didn't go to class. And then daddy called the president of the University of Pittsburgh and said, "Hey, my daughter's really important. She didn't go to class, but you should give her the MBA anyway." And they did. They gave it to her just because she's the head of a giant pharmaceutical company and her dad's a U.S. senator. They gave it to her. There was a huge scandal, and she finally was humiliated to the point where she had to agree to go back and take night classes to at least have the appearance of having worked for this MBA. These are the kinds of people we're dealing with in these pharmaceutical companies. They're just simply not honest, and they just simply don't care about you and me.
And that's really what's frightening, is because these are the people that are in charge of producing life-saving drugs. So, you know, John, you shouldn't have to have your life threatened every time you eat a meal. Because the truth is, there's cross-contamination, inspections sometimes fail, accidents happen, right? I mean, you know, that's just the reality of the world we live in. And an EpiPen means that what can be a fatal event turns into really just an unpleasant emergency room visit. And this is for many, many people in the United States. It's not just you. So what we've decided is that someone who's willing to lie about an MBA and willing to, you know, be in charge of a company that commits rampant fraud is also in charge for preserving our lives and charging us fees for these sorts of things. So that shows what a fundamental problem there is here. People, I guarantee, have died because of lack of access to the EpiPen because of this change. You're lucky that you've dodged a bullet and you're very careful, but other people haven't had that luxury. And so people have dropped dead because they've decided that they're going to increase the price 600%. Because why? Because they want to make more money. They have $12 billion and they want $12 billion more if they can get it. And one way they can do that is to charge it $600 for an EpiPen. So essentially, you know, they're putting lives in danger and killing people so that they can produce yet even more billions of dollars. And that is the United States healthcare system right now.
And that is also a perfect definition of the misnamed free market. People who suffer the same allergy that you do, John, don't have the right, absolute right, to have that which would protect you, which is the EpiPen.
Right. That's their conclusion.
You don't even have the right to have an affordable EpiPen, even though it was obviously the companies were making profits when they were selling it to you for a dollar. The free market means that the owners of Mylan, they have the freedom to charge you 600 times more or 6,000% more or whatever they want to charge you. That's the free market.
Literally, whatever they want.
So the free market is, you know, it's about words and language here. When we think about something being free, it sounds good, right? Free market, as opposed to a command market, as opposed to a state-directed market. A free market shows like human beings have freedom. But in fact, the freedom of the free market is the freedom of the owners to price gouge such that people who are dependent on this medicine can't access it and will die or will be seriously in danger. That's the free market. I want to rename the free market something else.
Yeah.
The cruel, the barbaric, the unfair, the unfree market. Something that's not a good word, because free is a good word. It connotes good things.
And I think really even the concept of the free market, when it's truly engaged in, is fought against by companies like Mylan. So the idea of the free market, that you have all these different producers that are out there competing with each other, trying to produce the best product for the cheapest price, this is the kind of idealization of capitalism that we supposedly live in. And what we live in is, of course, monopoly capitalism, where a very small group of people get to determine all the prices, all the production. But even when drug companies are forced to compete on even ground, and what I'm referring to is certain other countries, India especially, are not really interested in protecting Pfizer's and Mylan's intellectual property rights. They have their own issues that they're dealing with. They have their own priorities. And there are different drug manufacturers in those companies that will, in those countries, that will produce generics for very cheap, because it's very easy to do. And they have the factory and the capacity to do it. And they'll produce it for cheap and sell it to their citizens, and everybody's happy and gets their cheap generic drugs. Well, also citizens in the United States will try to buy them too. And there's a lot of online pharmacies in other countries like that where you can buy these cheap drugs so you can survive. What you see, though, is tons of lobbyists from those countries, from the United States, putting pressure on United States diplomats and governors, trying to put pressure on India and other countries like that to stop this practice, to crack down on all these companies producing cheap drugs. You also see a lot of interdiction and a lot of work being placed on departments like ICE to try to interdict shipments of these drugs into the U.S. that people buy online, and trying to hold people accountable, trying to destroy them because these are, you know, unlicensed, unregistered drugs. So we don't even want to compete in a free market. We don't even want to compete against a country like India that's willing to just undersell us. We'd rather completely monopolize the market and try to drive them out of it so that we can charge $600 for an EpiPen.
That's Daniel Sankey. Daniel's a financial policy analyst. He joins us every Tuesday in this segment of Loud and Clear, where we take a look at the big issues in the economy. Again, I want to stay with this story a little bit more because there's a lot to it. There's a lot of people in jail, a lot of people in jail for drug crimes. Now, why isn't what Mylan is doing a crime? Well, of course it's a crime. They're committing fraud. So the agency that's overseeing the companies that commit fraud, like Mylan, they come in and they say, this is not legal. Should we write a report? Like, go grab a couple of the CEOs and put them on trial and send them to prison for 15 years. But again,
and other countries do that.
Yeah.
Other countries imprison CEOs for things like that.
Yeah. So, but here's the FDA, you know, charged with the public trust to oversee these industries. There's no punishment. There's no accountability. These people do this with impunity. Another aspect of the so-called free market, which is the government will actually send poor people to jail, working folks to jail, people who are over-policed to jail. But the real big criminals, to the extent that you can commit big crimes like this one, that kind of guarantees you're not going to go to jail.
And I think even more than just, you know, Mylan and their fraud, I think of the pharmaceutical companies that produced opioids. Where, you know, as that story unfolds, we can see that the intention was very much to hide the incredibly addictive nature of these substances so that it could be marketed to as many people as possible and as something that's safe, something that's not addictive. And now the country is awash in all these high-end pharmaceuticals that people have become hopelessly addicted to. I'm thinking especially of this new substance, fentanyl, that's come out. It's a national state of emergency. It's an incredibly powerful opioid. People have died just accidentally inhaling it when it was aerosolized as dust. Like, different DEA agents have dropped dead because they were picking up bricks of it and some of it dusted into the air. They inhaled it and dropped dead. And this is the sort of stuff that these pharmaceutical companies have produced as necessary and safe and non-addictive. And don't worry, we can use it to, you know, conduct surgeries and other things like that. And so what you have is, you know, just a massive amount of addiction, mostly in poorer communities, mostly in communities that aren't able to organize and fight back as effectively as affluent communities to take on this, you know, tide of drugs that companies like Pfizer are pushing into it. And so what? They're drug lords, right? I mean, once upon a time, it was supposedly Latin America that had all these billionaire drug kingpins pushing cocaine into the United States. And we were supposed to, you know, hate them and interdict them and engage in all kinds of warfare in those countries.
Build a wall against them.
Build a wall against them, right? Well, we don't need to build a wall against them. We have the drug lords here. And they hang out with the president and they eat with the senators. And we put them up in very nice hotels and accept their money as lobbying donations so that, you know, we can ensure that their interests are protected. I mean, we were so terrified that we'd become a narco state, what with all the drugs flowing into the United States and Florida. We became a narco state here with Pfizer and others, assuming the level of power in government that they have so they can continue to poison communities with drugs that are not safe at all, that are supposedly marketed as safe. So, you know, that is what happens when the purpose of medicine is to create profit. Because it's much more profitable to create an army of addicts desperate for your substance than it is to actually produce something that helps protect people and charge them a price that they actually afford so they can improve the quality of their life. Why not create an army of addicts?
One more reason that the system, the healthcare system, has to change, where, again, as Daniel's pointing out, as long as healthcare or medicine is a commodity, there will be corruption, there will be greed, there will be avarice, and it's dominating. It's not just sort of anomalous behavior, because obviously the agencies of power or presumed power, like the FDA, Food and Drug Agency, they're actually in the pockets of the same industry. John, you've been to the Sackler Museum, no doubt, the Sackler Gallery.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Many, many times.
So the big drug lords are not only drug lords, they're also philanthropists.
Indeed. I mean, look at the Mellon family, right? I mean, they stole all their money when they first started. And that was Paul Mellon, who stole pretty much everything as Secretary of the Treasury. And then they let us see their artworks in various Smithsonian museums.
They're philanthropists. You spend a lifetime stealing, and then you create a little charity so that your name can go down in history as a benevolent, you know, whatever, someone for the people. Anyway, the Sacklers, I'm talking about the Sackler Memorial, the Sackler family is being sued by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts because they are, of course, the makers of OxyContin, the big opioid crisis. Guess how much the Sackler family paid itself through Purdue Pharmacy for their great work at bringing opioids into a mass market in the United States?
Uh-oh.
This is in the lawsuit. I'm just reading it. They paid themselves, this is the members of the family, they paid themselves $4 billion. That's part of the lawsuit. $4 billion between 2007 and 2018. Well, here's some other facts on it. Members of the Sackler family worked on a secret plan codenamed Tango, which would have expanded Purdue's business into addiction treatment drugs. So here we have it. They marketed aggressively opioid drugs, created a mass addiction problem in America, and now working through the FDA are going to be given license to provide the pharmaceutical treatment drugs for those who have become addicted to their drugs. It's amazing. What a racket.
I know this is a slight tangent, but I just read today that this 200 plus pound shipment of fentanyl that Daniel Sankey just referenced that was intercepted at the border the other day was being carried by someone who had a Department of Homeland Security fast pass, which means he had been cleared by the Department of Homeland Security.
That means he could have gotten through the wall?
Oh, yeah. There wouldn't have been a wall for this guy. He had a fast pass, meaning he had been cleared by the Department of Homeland Security as someone who has legitimate business in the United States and poses no sort of a security threat. And here he was smuggling more than 200 pounds of fentanyl, which has been so much of a problem when coupled with the opioid crisis that it's actually led to three consecutive years now where the life expectancy for men in the United States has fallen for the first time in a century.
The Sacklers, according to this lawsuit filed by the state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, these are some of the other things that this lawsuit alleges. Members of the family personally ordered Purdue to increase the sales force on a number of occasions. The family was directly involved in pushing for higher and more dangerous doses of OxyContin. For years, the McKinsey and Company consulting firm had worked with Purdue Pharmaceuticals to come up with sales tactics. According to a redacted section, the consultants, quote, had reported to Purdue in opportunities to increase prescriptions by convincing doctors that opioids provide, quote, freedom, that good word again, and peace of mind, also good words, and give patients, quote, the best possible chance to live a full and active life. Wow. I mean, this lawsuit is a dynamite lawsuit. Again, there's no criminal penalties. If they lose, they'll have to pay some money. And of course, that will become probably a tax write-off for the Sackler family. Anyway, they're philanthropists. They are here for the people, another charity. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I think especially when you talk about what they're paying back, their punishment is that they have to pay money. Well, it turns out they have a lot of that. So that's not really a problem. If they made, I don't know, $15 billion, or if they made $4 billion and they have to pay back $1 billion, hey, that was great. They made quite a bit of money. The idea that the courts won't go after the full amount, that every penny they made off of this process should be taken back so that they end up with nothing. And there needs to be criminal charges. I mean, if I sell drugs on the street, if I get their wonderful OxyContin that they produced and I go outside and I try to sell it to people, I can go to jail for a long time. I can get a heck of a lot of trouble. And that is just, you know, a small, small little supplier. When they're flooding the markets with it, you know, it's an entirely different thing altogether. I think also I want to speak to, you know, John talked about the Homeland Security issue where, you know, this guy was given clearance to smuggle drugs, essentially. You know, one of the things we see is that this endless flow of drugs into the United States because there's this, you know, demand for it. And this idea that, oh, it's just this unstoppable tide. We have to fight this kind of hopeless war on drugs. The truth is that the agencies responsible for interdicting these drugs and for stopping them are themselves hopelessly corrupt. The reason why so many drugs get in here is because huge numbers of them at very high levels are bribed, are corrupted by other organizations, and are limited in their power. You know, these other organizations have incredible power and incredible influence, and they utilize it. So the idea that they're here to help or protect us or create a secure border is ridiculous. They are extremely corrupt, and they will gladly allow certain shipments like that to get through if they get the right payments. So I think that's another thing we need to talk about as well, is the level of corruption there and how it really is kind of a joint effort to essentially get people hooked on drugs to produce, you know, massive fortunes, as these people will give every last single penny they have just to avoid the pain of withdrawals, so they can keep functioning using this stuff. So yes, Purdue and those families, Mylan, Pfizer, et cetera, all of them deserve criminal charges. All of them need to face the same sort of consequences that any sort of serious drug lord needs to face, and you know, should face serious jail time, that such that their lives would be as ruined as the other people's lives they've ruined.
Yeah, and it's not just the Sackler family. It's all of these companies. You know, John, we've talked about those lawsuits brought by the attorneys general in West Virginia counties where the opioid problem is wiping out communities.
Whole communities.
I mean, not just people dying.
But it's wrecking families.
Wrecking families, ruining. And again, people have pain because, let's say, they got injured or they worked for a long time in a mine, or because they're out of work now. Here's a lawsuit. The lawsuit filed by those attorneys general in West Virginia. And again, we're talking about 180,000 people have died in the United States from opioid overdoses or addiction since the year 2000, 180,000. Quote, this is from the lawsuit. This epidemic must be addressed through a multifaceted collaborative approach that includes the doctors who write the prescriptions, the pharmacists who dispense the drugs, the distributors who deliver the medicines, the manufacturers who make and promote the products, and the federal and state regulators who license and regulate these entities and determine supply. Why? Because at every level of down that chain, people are making profit. And the regulators are going to leave their jobs at some point, and they're going to go into a private industry, and they're going to work for these same companies. And they know that. So this whole revolving door as well, everybody's got a cut on it.
Yep.
Then on the other end, at the bottom end, is the consumer, the sick person, the person with pain, who's being overprescribed consciously. Now, the lawsuit file names McKesson Corporation, Cardinal Health, Amerisource, Bergen. It also names Walgreens, CVS, like everybody's
in on it.
Everybody's in on it. This whole corporate structure. Again, everybody, that's called the free market, but it's not free. And more than that, it's not the way healthcare should be accessed. It's not the way healthcare should be distributed. Huge problem in America. Big problem. And again, I see a few murmurings by some of the Democratic Party candidates talking about, you know, there should be Medicare for all. And of course, the opponents say, no, that'll bankrupt the country. The same argument that was made when the Republicans filibustered against the Medicare for the elderly bill when it was introduced and finally passed in 1964. Same argument. If you have Medicare for old people, the country will go into bankruptcy. Now, you know, if you told old people, sorry, we can't afford Medicare, they'd like, no, that obviously Medicare is considered a fundamental right, economic, social right in America. Anyway, we're getting down where time is winding down. Tonight is the State of the Union address. Daniel, what do you think? What's the State of the Union? What are your comments about Donald Trump's upcoming speech?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a then and now. If you can remember back to when Trump was elected, the stock market surged and it hit record highs shortly after his election and continued on for some time. You know, the billionaires that run those markets that push prices around very much believed in Donald Trump and were extremely excited about him. And their way of acknowledging that was this huge outpouring of capital into the stock market. You know, the Wall Street Journal and similar publications are very pro-Trump. They believe that he's just going to deregulate everything and give everyone tax breaks and sort of make it a paradise for them to kind of profit make. And while certainly we have seen deregulation and we saw the GOP tax plan, which is essentially just a big giveaway to the ultra-wealthy, wealthy and to the corporations. What we're seeing now is the kind of hangover from all that. And the fact that we have an economy on a global level that's in decline and that it's starting to enter a bear phase, it's starting to pull back and it's starting to enter recessionary things. And there's a lot of cracks everywhere. Trump's not going to acknowledge that. You know, he's going to go up there and say, oh, we brought back manufacturing, even though Ford, GM, and the other automakers have cut, you know, tens of thousands of jobs because they're trying to pivot their operations. So even the supposed, you know, American heartland, the factory workers that Trump is interested in protecting are now losing their jobs in huge numbers because, of course, this trade war against China is extremely costly. And when things like that happen, the people that are first to get hurt are workers. And that's what's happening here. So I think right now there's this big hangover from this huge kind of artificial influx of capital that we saw when the ultra wealthy thought, yeah, Trump's going to do it. Trump's going to make it so that, you know, profit making is just so easy and we're going to just make money hand over fist, to now the realities of the situation, which is a more fractured global network, a rolling back of global relations between both longtime allies of the US and Europe and other close business partners like China. And the downstream effects is this global instability that we're seeing in capital. I think a lot of those very wealthy billionaires that were excited about it are now pretty disappointed with it and pretty troubled. But unfortunately, really, who's going to get hurt is the working people who supposedly Trump really cared about. Supposedly Trump wanted to fight for the little guy and get them jobs and get them, you know, back on track. And they're the ones that are ultimately going to suffer from this kind of ineptitude and lack of diplomacy that Trump has across the world. So will we see him acknowledge this? No. He's going to try to play up that he's the most incredible thing in the world. But it's, you know, it rings hollow. That's what he does every time. Every time he's given the opportunity to speak, he talks about that he's, you know, God's gift to the presidency. And I think, you know, it falls on a lot of deaf ears now because it just becomes this repetitive, nauseating soundbite.
That's Daniel Sankey. I want to turn real quick to the other headline you flagged for us. It's from the Wall Street Journal. The malaise in global trade is only getting worse. What does that signify? 1 minute left.
Yeah. So really what that signifies is that China's markets are slowing down, that they're not purchasing as much as they used to, and that consumers are kind of pulling back. And really why that matters is that impacts the global market and it impacts the United States. So our economic prosperity is tied to Chinese prosperity. And the idea that somehow this trade war will hurt China only to benefit us ignores the fact that our economies are so interlinked with one another. And that's what this means. It also goes to Europe. Same situation with Europe. This idea that we can just tariff some of their stuff and it won't hurt us is a pipe dream. So as these economies sag and weaken under the onslaught of this trade war, this tariff war, and this instability that Trump's produced, the downstream effect is the United States economy weakens. And the consumers that consume our materials, that utilize our materials, and also sell to us are pulling back and not able to produce at quite the level and the profitability that they had before. So we're going to see a continued downturn throughout 2019. Will it become officially a recession? I'm not sure, but there is a high likelihood that we're going to see it at a global level and not just in the U.S.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. Daniel's a financial policy analyst. He joins us every Tuesday here at Loud and Clear for this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Of course, we'll have this show, as we do all of our shows, featured on Facebook and also at our Twitter, Loud Clear Radio, so that you can share it. Daniel Sankey, thank you so much. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.